This program is provided by a trusted partner of the church and is educational, inspirational, and uplifting. It does not necessarily represent the official position of the church.
I'm impressed with this statement by a Presbyterian minister in Kirtland who said, "Whatever other Mormons may have been, Hiram was a perfect gentleman."
Coming up next, A Life of Integrity, Hiram Smith.
From the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Channel now presents the Joseph Smith Papers.
KJAZ Television, in cooperation with the Church History Department of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, presents this weekly series highlighting the research of scholars and historians as they prepare for the publication of the Joseph Smith Papers. And now your host, Glenn Rawson.
Hiram Smith was born February the 9th, 1800, in Tunbridge, Vermont, to Joseph and Lucy Max Smith. And though his younger brother Joseph would later stand as the prophet of the Restoration, it would be a mistake to believe that Joseph stood alone. Throughout his life, and especially in death, Hiram stood next to and was supportive of his younger brother Joseph. Tonight, in our show, scholar and biographer Jeff O'Driscoll will share insights into the life of Patriarch Hiram Smith. We begin November the 19th, 1823, with another of the Smith brothers, Alvin.
Jeffrey S. O'Driscoll.
Hiram had this marvelous relationship that we don't hear much about with Alvin. Alvin died in 1823. Hiram was about 23 years old at the time. Joseph was still a teenager. And before he died, Alvin called Hiram to the bedside and commended the care of the family to him, told him to take care of their parents as they aged. And Hiram took that responsibility very seriously. What I find interesting about this relationship is that a few years later, when Joseph Sr. gave Hiram a patriarchal blessing, he spent a significant portion of Hiram's patriarchal blessing talking about Alvin, around whose heart Hiram's affections were twined, as the blessing says. In 1835, Joseph said of Hiram, I would that all of my brethren were like unto my brother Hiram Smith, who has the mildness of a lamb and the integrity of a Job, and in short, the meekness and humility of Christ. And I never had occasion to rebuke him, nor he me. 7 years later, in 1842, after the experience of Liberty Jail, after many more opportunities together, Joseph said that Hiram's name was written in the Lamb's Book of Life for those who come after to pattern their works. So on two different occasions, Joseph held Hiram up as the example for everybody to follow. And he looked to him as the older brother.
Considering that the Smith brothers were large men for their time, what did Hiram look like?
Hiram's oldest son, John, later said that Joseph was 6 feet in his stockings and weighed 212 pounds, and Hiram was 1/2 inch shorter but of equal weight. One of the things that I think is telling about Hiram's physical description actually comes from an account of his son, Joseph F. Smith, when he was traveling to go on a mission to Great Britain and he stopped in Nauvoo on his way. And those who knew Joseph and Hiram when they were alive saw Joseph F. and said that they'd have known that he was Hiram's son anywhere because he looked so much like Joseph and Hiram. So Joseph and Hiram looked quite a bit alike. And if you want a picture of what they looked like, a young Joseph F. Smith comes pretty close.
November the 2nd, 1826. Hiram married Jerusha Barden in Manchester, New York.
By all accounts, Jerusha was a wonderful woman, one that filled the home with love. Hiram frequently had boarders in his home, and the boarders in the home commented about what a wonderful woman Jerusha was as well. She and Hiram married in 1826, just about a year before Joseph received the plates. And in fact, their first child, Levina, was born within days of when Joseph received the plates. Jerusha and Hiram were married for about 11 years. They had 6 children. Levina was born at that time. Mary was their next child. She was born in the spring of 1829, just about the time Hiram was becoming a witness of the plates and seeing them physically with his own eyes. Their next child was John. He was born just after little Mary's death. Mary lived to be almost 3 years old, and in 1832, she died in Hiram's arms, and he wrote a very moving account of it in his journal. A few months later, in September, John was born. That was their third child. Their fourth child was Hiram, although, interestingly, Hiram spelled his son's name differently. There's a letter he wrote from Liberty Jail, which very clearly has his son's name written, H-I-R-A-M, right above Hiram's own signature, which is very clearly H-Y-R-U-M. I'm not aware of any explanation why Hiram chose to spell his son's name differently. Hiram lived several years, but he died in his youth as well in Nauvoo. Their next child was Jerusha. She was born just about the time they were getting ready to dedicate the Kirtland Temple. His sixth child was Sarah. She was born in October of 37, just a few days after Hiram left on church assignment to go to Far West, where he was sustained as a counselor in the first presidency. Shortly after he arrived in Missouri, he got a letter from his younger brothers, Don Carlos and Samuel Harrison. It started out with words to the effect, "Hiram, we know it's the desire of every man to know the state of his family." And then they proceeded to tell him that Jerusha had died shortly after giving birth to Sarah. She'd gathered the children around her, told them that Hiram would take care of them, and bid them farewell before she died. Hiram made the lonely trek home to Kirtland. He got there in December. And Joseph, according to family tradition, counseled Hiram that the children needed a mother and that he should remarry again soon. And some accounts suggest that he even recommended Mary Fielding as Hiram's next wife. She married him in December. In less than a year, the following fall in 1838, gave birth to Joseph F. Smith, who was born while Hiram was incarcerated in Missouri. A little bit later, she gave birth to Martha Ann. And although she was just a little girl at the time of her father's death, she remembered that he always seemed serious, as though he was preoccupied with something. He was later also married for time to Mary's sister, Mercy Thompson, after her husband, Robert B. Thompson, passed away. She described him, an affectionate husband, a loving father, a faithful friend, and a warm-hearted benefactor. And another woman named Catherine Phillips was sealed to Hiram. And in fact, her obituary later appeared in the Improvement Era as a widow of Hiram Smith.
Elder John Taylor later described Joseph and Hiram's relationship this way. He said, "In life, they were not divided." And indeed, such was the case.
Unlike many of the prophets in the scriptures whose older brothers persecuted them and bound them and sold them into slavery, as in the case of Joseph in Egypt, Hiram listened to his younger brother. And I think Hiram viewed himself as a friend of the prophet. He said near the end of his life that there were prophets before, but Joseph has the spirit and power of all the prophets. I have never encountered anything that suggested that he was anything other than happy to follow Joseph and let Joseph be the prophet. When he was in Zion's camp, Joseph suggested the brethren should camp on the prairie, and there was some debate about whether that was the right thing to do or not. And while the brethren were debating whether or not to follow Joseph, Hiram literally reached down and picked up the stick, the standard, the flag that the company had followed, and he started to lead, and they followed him onto the prairie. So Hiram seemed completely bereft of ego. He didn't have to be anything other than what he was, and he always pointed the people to Joseph. In Kirtland, he spoke to the elders' quorum, cautioned them not to murmur against Joseph. when he wrote a letter to Charles C. Rich, he told him, he warned him, don't think hard of Joseph. He has a hard row to hoe. And so he was always pointing toward Joseph. The saints were assembled in Joseph's home. Hiram was speaking, and he was speaking with a little bit of excess of zeal about the scriptures and said we should take them as our guide alone. And after he finished, Joseph elbowed Brigham to get up and speak, and Brigham said he was charged with powder and ball, and he felt quite animated about his feelings, and there must have been a lectern of some kind there because he took the scriptures as they had them and piled them one on top of another and said, I wouldn't give the ashes of a rye straw for all of these things if we didn't have the living oracles. We should take the prophet as our guide. Hiram followed Brigham to the pulpit. And remember, although Brigham was the president of the Quorum of the Twelve, Hiram was the assistant president of the church. He had just been soundly and publicly corrected by his priesthood subordinate, if you will. And yet he came and humbly acknowledged his mistake. Brigham Young later referred to it as a handsome apology and acknowledged that he had made a mistake in leaving out the oracles as a source of truth. So he was happy to acknowledge when he made an error. He was humble that way.
Hiram was involved from the very beginning, serving in many callings and capacities from the very beginning of the Restoration. Then, on January the 19th, 1841, Hiram was designated as Assistant President of the Church.
And as it says in Revelation, all of those things, the priesthood, the powers, the keys, everything that was once upon Oliver Cowdery is now put upon Hiram Smith. And most people believe that it was that reason that Hiram Smith went to Carthage with Joseph and shed his blood with Joseph as the second witness of the Restoration. Okay. Joseph made it very clear when he described the office of assistant president that it had ascendancy and authority over the counselors in the first presidency. There's a very interesting account by a man named John Riggs. He said he was there the first day that they did baptisms for the dead in the Mississippi River, which would have been back in August or September of 1840. Months before the revelation. He said, I was present when Joseph baptized Brother Hiram and said, today I weld the link of priesthood that was broken by Oliver Cowdery. For in life we shall be one, and in death we shall not be separated. Hiram had a marvelous perspective. He understood whom he was. And that in no way detracted from who Joseph was. And so in his final general conference, Hiram stood up and he gave this wonderful address. In fact, he spoke each day of the conference. And in one of those addresses, he said to the people, I am not to be dictated to by anyone except Joseph and God. One of his big areas of involvement was the Book of Mormon. Hiram became one of the witnesses of the Book of Mormon, of course, and he spoke about that throughout the rest of his life. Even in Carthage, he was still bearing testimony of the Book of Mormon. Another area of his involvement is in the Kirtland Temple. The saints had been told to build this temple, and they were kind of slow to respond to some of the Lord's directions until he chastened them in a revelation. Joseph had a meeting and laid out some of his views of the temple. Hiram was so excited by the meeting, he ran home and grabbed a scythe. And as he was leaving the house, his mother asked him where he was going. He said that they were going to build a temple, and he was determined to be the first at the work. And so he ran back to the field where they lowered the fence and began cutting the wheat. And when the field was cleared, Hiram was the first one to start digging the trenches for the walls, declaring that he wanted to be the first at the work. He was a charter member of the School of the Prophets and spoke in tongues in the School of the Prophets. Hiram had this generous outpouring of the gifts of the Spirit. He spoke in tongues. He administered to people who were miraculously healed. In fact, on one occasion, Wilford Woodruff had been very ill, but he was summoned to a meeting with the 12 in Nauvoo. They went to John Taylor's home to have this meeting. John Taylor was also sick, too sick to host the meeting. So they went to Hiram's office, where they held the meeting. Wilford was so ill, he laid down on a bench and stopped breathing. The brethren raised him up. He began to breathe again, and Hiram administered to him, and he was miraculously restored to health. Hiram saw visions. He prophesied about the fate of Kirtland. He prophesied about his own death. He saw angels in the Kirtland Temple.
Hiram Smith was a man of compassion and a devoted preacher of the gospel. There were many who came into the church because of him.
Parley P. Pratt was another one who came to Palmyra. He'd heard of the Book of Mormon, and he'd seen it a bit even, but he wanted to know more about it. And he came inquiring after Joseph, and he was walking along the road. He encountered Herder on the road and asked for Joseph, and he said, Joseph's not here, but can I help you? I'm his brother. And it was Hiram. He took Parley into his home. They stayed up all night learning about the gospel and sharing what Hiram knew with Parley. And the next morning when Parley left, Hiram gave him a copy of the Book of Mormon, which Parley treasured and read voraciously. He had to go to another commitment, but he came back shortly thereafter, and he spent another whole night with Hiram learning the gospel. And then the next day, Hiram walked 25 miles with Parley to Seneca Lake to answer his request for baptism. Another one was Orson Hyde. Orson Hyde kind of got crosswise of the church a little bit in Missouri. And he came to Heber C. Kimball and Hiram and asked their help to present his case. Actually, Orson came to Heber, and then Heber went to Hiram. And Hiram presented such a moving case for Orson Hyde that Joseph withdrew the proposed sanctions against Orson and said that if Hiram could speak on his behalf, then he'd let the charges go. And Orson later said that Hiram had been his friend and come to his aid in a time of greatest need and loved him for it.
Just as it was with Joseph, there were foreshadowings of a martyr's death for Hiram as well.
When Hiram came back from Zion's camp, he was called into the first presidency, and he also received a special blessing. If it please thee, and thou desirest, thou shalt have the power voluntarily to lay down thy life to glorify God. That was in 1834, he was told that. As the events in Nauvoo escalated, Hiram was in the city council meeting where they decided to declare the Nauvoo expositor a nuisance and have it abated. But in that meeting, there was a young teenager who was an assistant to John Taylor, the editor of the Times and Seasons. That young teenage boy was George Q. Cannon. And he heard Joseph and Hiram speaking in between the sessions of the meeting. And Hiram said he'd lay down his life before he'd allow the expositor to continue to defame their wives and children in the way that it had done. And what's moving about Hiram Smith is the way that he affected the people who heard him. Because George Q. Cannon said, when he said it, it went through me, and I felt as he did. So this is Joseph speaking to the 12 in the spring of 1844. Nine members of the 12 were present, and Hiram was there. As the second elder and assistant president of the church, Hiram assisted the prophet in bestowing upon the 12 this authority. And in fact, later in a written statement of the 12, it talks about both Joseph and Hiram having their hands upon their heads and anointing them in conjunction with this event. Orson Hyde said, "Now, why did he say to the 12, 'On your shoulders will this responsibility rest'? Why did he not mention Brother Hiram?" Then answering his own question, Orson Hyde said, "The Spirit knew that Hiram would be taken with him, and hence he did not mention his name." So that was Orson Hyde's take on why Hiram wasn't discussed in any measure with regards to the succession of authority, because those in positions of authority knew what was going to take place.
Notwithstanding this, Joseph tried repeatedly to get Hiram to leave. And Hiram's response was always the same. "Joseph, I cannot leave you." Then June 23rd, 1844, just 4 days before the martyrdom, on the west bank of the Mississippi River, Joseph experienced a most revealing dream. He described it this way.
I dreamed that myself and my brother Hiram went on board of a large steamboat lying in a small bay near the great ocean. Shortly after we went on board, there was an alarm of fire, and I discovered that the boat had been anchored some distance from the shore, out in the bay, and that an escape from the fire in the confusion appeared hazardous. But as delay was folly, I and Hiram jumped overboard and tried our faith at walking upon the water. At first, we sank in the water nearly to our knees, but as we proceeded, we increased in faith and were soon able to walk upon the water. As the dream progressed, they walked across this mighty deep, as he referred to it, and saw a city with gold and silver steeples and towers more beautiful than anything on the earth. He said of that experience, "It was more than I could describe. The greeting of old friends, the music from a thousand towers, and the light of God himself at the return of three of his sons soothed my soul into a quiet joy that I felt as I was truly in heaven." When he says the three sons, what he's referring to was as the dream progressed, Hiram and Joseph, as they're walking on the water, were soon caught up by their brother Samuel, who walked with them into the glorious city. A powerful foreshadowing of Samuel's death just 3 weeks after the martyrdom due to the exhaustion that he suffered in fleeing from the mob that killed his brothers.
That same day, still on the west side of the Mississippi, Joseph received a letter from some back in Nauvoo requesting that he return to the city. At that point, he turned to his brother Hiram.
"Brother Hiram, you are the oldest. What shall we do?" Hiram replied, "Let's go back and give ourselves up and see the thing out." After pondering a few minutes, Joseph remarked, "If you go back, I will go with you, but we shall be butchered." Hiram answered, No, let us go back and put our trust in God, and we shall not be harmed. The Lord is in it. If we live or have to die, we will be reconciled to our fate." If you take this statement out of context, you may have the impression that Hiram didn't know what was coming. But he'd declared less than 24 hours before, "Just as sure as we fall into their hands, we are dead men." So you kind of get this feeling that he had the same kind of hope that Joseph had early that morning when he comforted Hiram's wife and said, "It'll be all right." It wasn't going to be all right in that they were going to live. It was going to be all right in the eternal scheme of things. Later that day, Joseph and Hiram came back to Nauvoo to help collect the arms of the militia that had been ordered to be collected by the government. And Hiram saw his 5-year-old son, Joseph F., standing in the dusty street. Without getting off of his horse, he rode up, reached down, lifted Joseph F. Smith into his saddle, embraced him, kissed him, and said goodbye, and lowered him back down to the street. And Joseph stood there and watched his father, Hiram, ride away to Carthage. Never saw him alive again.
June 27th, 1844, Carthage Jail.
One thing that is interesting is almost invariably historians attribute to Joseph the request of John Taylor to sing "A Poor Wayfaring Man of Grief." But John Taylor was there. He knew who asked him. And in his later accounts of the events, he said it was Hiram that asked him to sing it, both the first time and the second time. Interestingly, it was Hiram that was the first to die. The bullet came through the door, hit him in the head, and he fell to the ground saying, "I am a dead man." Joseph knelt at his side and held his brother for a moment before trying to save his friends and himself from what would follow. But it must have been horrible for him to see his brother lying there on the floor.
We close this show where we started. Hiram Smith was a life worthy of emulation.
Joseph gave Hiram a blessing in 1833 and said, "Blessed of the Lord is my brother Hiram for the integrity of his heart." But Joseph wasn't the only person that felt that way. John Taylor described Hiram as a man of sterling integrity and said he was an example of honesty and virtue and all that is noble. Brigham Young said, "Hiram was as good a man as ever lived. His integrity was of the highest order. I used to think and think now that an angel dwelling in the presence of the Father and the Son possessed no more integrity in their hearts than did Hiram Smith." He said, He is just as honest as an angel and as full of integrity as the gods. And then, of course, you have the Lord in Revelation saying, I, the Lord, love him because of the integrity of his heart and because he loveth that which is right before me.
Next week on the Joseph Smith Papers, two very different brothers who gave their all for the Restoration, Parley and Orson Pratt. I'm Glenn Rawson. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to the Joseph Smith Papers here on the Mormon Channel, a production of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.